Hello and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later.
Each time someone waits for a bus 40 minutes, it's because of tax havens. Every time someone waits for an important surgery for months from an hospital, it's because of tax havens. Every time there are a lack of nurses or professors in hospitals or in schools, it's because of tax havens.
We talked to Canadian philosopher, sociologist and author Alain Denault about his fascinating new book, Legalizing Theft, A Short Guide to Tax Havens. We ask, how can we change the words we use to reflect the realities? But first, here's a very quick roundup of some important tax justice news this month. Last month, we talked about Pilatus Bank in Malta, the focus of Maltese hero and investigative journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia before she was murdered. It was finally the focus of a European Banking Authority investigation at the request of the EU Commission last month. The bank was actually suing Daphne over her allegations, a case it dropped after her death. Now the chair of the bank, an Iranian national, has been arrested on US charges. Those charges allege his involvement in a scheme to evade US sanctions and funnel over $115 million paid out as part of a Venezuelan construction contract through all sorts of shell companies in Switzerland, Turkey and the British Virgin Islands. Anti-corruption protesters in Malta have actually placed washing machines outside Pilatus Bank and the Malta Financial Services Authority to express their anger about how their country's been opened up for money laundering. The bank's chair, by the way, had bought himself a St. Kitts and Nevis passport from British company Henley & Partners. The bank was alleged to be involved in brokering passports for sale deals, very appealing to Russians, apparently. Murdered journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia alleged high-level political corruption benefiting from those schemes. Now, a former Pilatus Bank employee, a Russian national, has turned herself in to the police in Greece. She was the source for Daphne Caruana Galizia's allegations, which went to the heart of the Maltese government. In what looks like part of a possible smear campaign against this whistleblower, tax havens Malta and Cyprus have now issued a European warrant for her arrest. The whistleblower says she fears for her life. No more time for more news, unfortunately. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. OK, John, the big news this month is the attempted murder, the poisoning of a former Russian spy and his daughter in Britain, potentially the murder of at least one other Russian, a businessman, and very critical of the Russian government. We've talked before on the TaxCast about the international security threat the City of London poses, or Londongrad, as it's referred to. Also its satellite havens, the dangers that they pose in facilitating corruption and profiting from it. They're also enabling the powerful to keep their grip on a country like Russia. And that's really hurting Russian people in this kind of mafia state. So this cozying up to oligarchs and embezzlers the world over, not just Russian oligarchs, letting them buy up multi-million pound properties secretly, that way exceed the official salaries that they're earning. And, you know, Britain's actually helped out with the sale of stolen assets from Russia, for example, the flotation in London of Rosneft, the oil company, which was created from stolen assets of another oil company, and the owner of that was sent to prison in Siberia. Now, this doesn't hurt just Russians. It's like a rot, this kind of thing that sort of spreads and eats away at all our democratic institutions until they become just sort of empty facades. We're now starting to see the consequences of that in London.
Yep, you know, there's a long history to London's connections, which go back to the Soviet Union and what later became the Russian Federation. As Britain's tax haven economy expanded in the 1970s and after that, senior Soviet officials got quite used to using Britain's tax haven economy to hide their personal wealth, very often laddering the wealth through Cyprus onto the British Virgin Islands or the Channel Islands in the direction of London. So Londongrad has history. Now, at the time when the Soviet Union collapsed, I was employed as economic advisor to the government of Jersey, which is a British tax haven. And I remember having lunch with the director of a Jersey-based trust company, and this must have been about 1990, 1991, and he told me, he was very excited, he just landed a Russian client whose personal wealth exceeded $100 million. I challenged him and said, how can anyone from the Soviet Union possibly have obtained such a huge sum legally? But he wasn't interested. My lunch partner wasn't interested. And I think, by and large, the whole British financial establishment was never going to ask any awkward questions about where did this money come from. So if you look at what happened in the years after the fall of the Soviet Union, something between 20 billion to 30 billion of stolen assets were transferred offshore annually. London was the destination of choice for dirty money. And that's why London earned this reputation in Russia of being Londongrad. By and large, Russian oligarchs have been allowed to come to London, take up residence without any awkward questions being asked about the origins of their wealth. On the contrary, they've been given preferential terms. For example, they can come into Britain on what's called Tier 1 visas. They've been granted non-domiciled tax status, which means that any income which they earn anywhere in the world doesn't get taxed in Britain, even if they're living here, as long as they don't remit that income into England itself. Needless to say, they hold it all offshore and don't remit the income. They've been wooed by the political parties who are chasing donations from them. We've witnessed political parties pulling all sorts of stunts to attract donations. And let's not pretend that these stunts, including the foreign secretary playing a game of tennis with a Russian person who paid 160 grand to do that, let's not pretend that comes without strings attached. There are strings attached to this. They bought massively into the London property market. They're served by this pliant and obsequious army of bankers and lawyers. So if you fast forward to Britain today, what we're seeing is the consequences of opening the doors to tens of thousands of Russian oligarchs. Generally speaking, Russian oligarchs haven't become insanely rich on the back of all their hard work and business flair that you normally expect of this, you know, high-level business people. They gained their wealth through plunder, often from privatisation schemes like Rosneft, as you mentioned, that sold off state-owned assets at a tiny fraction of their real worth. And their wealth, by and large, is invested in property or other rent-seeking investments. In other words, they don't invest in productive activity. This is made worse by the fact they're given this non-dom tax status. Few of them pay any tax at all. So there's little evidence that they either boost foreign trade, boost employment, boost investment, or pay tax. And now we see a string of unexplained murders within the oligarch community. The problem now facing the British government is that, having turned a blind eye to all those dirty flows over all these decades, any attempt to argue the moral high ground is simply going to be laughed at. Londongrad will not be taken seriously in Moscow because the London elites, including our leading politicians, have become too closely embedded with the oligarch community.
Right, and these are really dangerous times, as we're seeing, and these are very powerful people. They're not messing around. And we should make the point that Londongrad is a state of mind more than a place, really, where we're seeing murder, lawlessness and oppression spreading. It's logical, really. This is how democracy dies.
You're quite right. It's a state of mind. And unfortunately, culturally, there is this huge gap between these oligarchs, many of whom come with a set of social values that don't fit in at all with contemporary Britain. You know, I mean, who by and large are completely separate from the rest of London.
And when you look at the sort of oppression that's going on in places like Malta, which can show us the direction of travel, where anybody who dares to criticise and expose corruption, such as the investigative journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia that we talked about a lot on the Tapscast, is murdered. And we've had another murder recently with the investigative journalist who looked a lot into tax evasion in Slovakia, Jan Kuciak. And these are kind of mafia-style executions, yeah, that are taking place here in the heart of the European Union. There's a lot of court cases, and often Britain is used as a useful jurisdiction for court cases to shut down media exposés on what's actually going on in terms of corruption. And Sean Walker of The Guardian, a journalist at a British newspaper, said recently, and I'm quoting, "The time between making quiet inquiries about the wealth or circumstances of dubious Russian businessmen and The Guardian legal team receiving a threatening letter from expensive London lawyers has been under 24 hours at times." These are dangerous people.
Yeah, and these are very dangerous times, because unfortunately we now find ourselves in a situation where anyone who challenges Britain's position on this, by which I mean the way in which we've been very accommodating to some pretty nasty gangster types, dangerous thugs in many cases, is regarded as a traitor. And that's another sign of the shift towards very authoritarian responses within Britain itself. So I think hosting these super rich oligarch communities has exposed British democracy to some very unpleasant cultural shifts, which are taking us in the direction of authoritarian government in Britain itself.
Right, and all is not lost before everybody switches off. because I am quite relieved to see that although there's been silence from the government itself in Britain, as far as I can see on this, in terms of usefully addressing these problems, the main political opposition in the UK has put forward a 5-point plan to deal with this, which is very much what the Tax Justice Network has been campaigning for all these years, is to stop allowing secret ownership, whether it's through trusts, foundations or companies.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, of course, there's lots that can be done and needs to be done immediately. And first of all, we need to stop giving oligarchs, in fact, the super rich generally, this special tax treatment. Let's drop the non-dom tax ruling entirely. It serves absolutely no interest whatsoever for the country as a whole. It only serves the interests of the super rich. And why do we need to give them tax breaks? So anyone who wants to live in Britain must be prepared to live on equal terms with everybody else. They should disclose their property holdings and not hide their wealth behind secret offshore companies. London must now extend transparency of beneficial ownership of companies to all of its satellite secrecy jurisdictions, so the Russian oligarchs and oligarchs from other countries don't hide behind Bermudan companies or BVI, Cayman and Channel Islands companies. They must all be required to have public registries of true ownership. Another thing which the opposition has been talking about now is to widen the definition of the existing politically exposed persons regime to capture a larger pool of the oligarchs who are connected, even indirectly, with high-level politicians, not just in Russia, I'd stress, but also China, Saudi Arabia and all of the other places where Britain's actively trying to attract oligarch wealth. So all the other authoritarian regimes where leaders surround themselves with circles of corrupt oligarchs, we must now identify them as politically exposed persons and request the lawyers and the bankers who manage their wealth to treat them as PEPs, so-called. A fourth measure which is proposed is that Britain, which now has an innovative legal mechanism for confiscating unexplained wealth, what that does is it places the onus on the owners of wealth, London property, for example, to demonstrate that the wealth was obtained legitimately. If the British government is serious about applying pressure on the Kremlin or any other place, these unexplained wealth orders provide a means for squeezing the oligarchs. This will put pressure on authoritarian regimes to be a little bit more respectful of other democracies. And finally, I think government needs to extend and improve the protections given to whistleblowers, to investigators, you mentioned murdered investigating journalists, any other people who take on the corrupt practices of the business and political elites. There's this so-called Magnitsky Clause, which is now enacted in the Criminal Finances Bill. I know it's not a perfect enactment, but it is there. And this allows for sanctions to be taken against anyone who abuses, any government who abuses human rights or target whistleblowers. And this is a very, very important measure, because time and again we've seen it's the whistleblowers and the investigators who bring this corruption to the surface. It isn't governments and politicians by and large. Too often the people who struggle against corrupt practices pay far too high a price, even death, as we know. So we need to shift the balance in their favour.
Right. Let's move on. We're going to talk about some good news that follows from President Trump's new tax reforms in the United States. great news for people buying new private jet planes, that is. because when you buy one, you can now write it off in full against tax. Isn't that great? So you could wipe out your tax bill completely, apparently. President Trump has long owned his own private jet, of course. And he just wants to even out the field, I'm sure, to make that possible for everyone in the country.
Yeah, private jets on demand. A few years ago, social theorist Andrew Sayer wrote a fascinating book with a very provocative title. The title of the book was Why We Can't Afford the Rich. And one of the issues he raised in this book was this issue of wealthy elites flying around in untaxed private jets. Now, part of Andrew Sayer's concern was to do with the environmental damage this causes, which raises big questions about why, in a world of, you know, climate disruption, why are aviation fuels entirely exempt from excise duties almost across the entire world? This is a massive market failure which subsidises polluters and encourages inefficient energy use. It turns out the key reason why aviation fuels are duty-free lies with the lobbying power of big corporations and wealthy private jet owners. Surprise, surprise. Another concern lies with the use of offshore companies to avoid value-added tax, which happens on a massive scale, particularly in the area of top-end jets and top-end yachts. And we recently saw, BBC actually investigated this as a result of one of the outcomes of the Paradise Papers leaks, showed how tax haven facilities on the British Isle of Man were being used by private jet owners, including Formula One champion Lewis Hamilton, to avoid value-added tax. So that's another one of the concerns. And then, of course, there's Donald Trump. Of course, Trump uses a converted Boeing 757, which reputedly cost him $100 million to fly down. He just uses it to fly down to play golf in Florida, which is an appalling misuse of aviation fuel. President Trump isn't exactly at the forefront of the global campaign to slow down climate disruption, so there's no point in expecting him to apply an excise duty to aviation fuel. But this latest tax measure is arguably one of the most brazen examples of how the president is shaping a tax regime in the United States that is almost entirely designed to suit the needs and, let's say, the greed of plutocrats. For billionaires and multimillionaires, the kind of people who buy private jets, this provision is manna from heaven, since it allows them to almost entirely wipe out their tax bill in the year they buy their latest jet. And apparently they buy jets quite regularly because they keep turning them over. They keep them for a few years and then replace them. Now, when you consider the global market for private aviation is something in the region of $23 billion US dollars every year, this is one hell of a big tax break. It can only encourage many more wealthy people to take to the skies and increase their contribution to global pollution even further. So Andrew Sayer hit the nail on the head when he said we can't afford the rich.
Thanks, John. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. They say history is written by the victors. And when it comes to the language and words we use that frame our understanding of tax havens, secrecy and finance, they can trap us into a way of thinking that's become normalised, common sense. So can we find alternative words that convey the upside-down realities of the world we're living in? Can we reword offshore?
It's a scandal because everything works upside down.
This is Alain Denault, philosopher, sociologist and author.
It's quite clear with the recent scandals, the leaks, the Paradise Papers, the Panama Papers, the offshore leaks, there's Lux leaks, Swiss leaks and so on and so forth. What we see at each scandal is how close are the relationships between corporations that use tax havens and the politicians that make them accessible or try to shape their own jurisdiction so that they look like tax havens. This is a real problem.
Back in 2009, some world leaders were making pretty grand speeches about ending tax havens. Here's French president at the time, Nicolas Sarkozy.
Que je cite entre guillemets, le temps du secret bancaire est révolu. Je distingue. principe. Le temps du secret bancaire est révolu.
And British Prime Minister at the time, Gordon Brown, was saying similar things.
There will be an end to tax havens that do not transfer information on request. The banking secrecy of the past must come to an end.
I'm speaking to Alain de Nault about his new book, Legalising Theft, A Short Guide to Tax Havens. Alain, in your book you identify a really important moment when then-President Sarkozy of France told a G8 summit it was all over for tax havens and banking secrecy. A lot of people really laughed at that because they thought it was a naive thing to say. But you actually think it was significant for a completely different reason. Sarkozy was actually saying that they were going to get rid of them, but by copying that model and kind of making them irrelevant.
Yes, no Western country nowadays really tries to tackle tax havens. They tend to imitate them instead of working against them. If there was any kind of willingness to tackle them, since a long time, these presidents or premiers would have fought tax haven on a diplomatic level and not on a technical level as it is the case today. If they were serious that tax havens have to be fought against, they would put them under pressure on a diplomatic level, exactly what the U.S. did against Cuba for whole other reasons for years. Instead, they imitate tax havens. They reduce tax income rates on corporations' assets and so on and so forth. And when they say tax havens are over, often they show that their involvement in tax competitiveness in the world is so strong that they wish to see tax havens useless in the forthcoming time.
Right, and useless because they're going to do it better. The Canadian example's really interesting, actually, because it's kind of framed its whole economy around the offshore model in a way that just seems absolutely crazy.
Yeah, Canada did two things quite amazing to create loopholes so that the financial establishment could legally bypass the fiscal and legal system. In 1980, Canada signed a treaty with Barbados against double taxation. But when Canadian government decided to sign such an agreement with Barbados in 1980, they knew perfectly that the income tax rate for these corporations that have no local activities in Barbados as such only paid between 1% and 2.5% of tax. So it was a way to legally allow Canadian corporations to transfer assets there and bring them back in Canada without paying tax. So the result is that nowadays, each year, Barbados is either second or the third country where Canadian corporations in the world invest the most after the US and the UK.
Right, and you point out as well that Canada's also home to 75% of the world's mining companies. So that's interesting. And Canada also then signed a load of bilateral information sharing agreements with various countries around the world, which would seem like a good idea, but they then legislated in Canada to make those agreements pretty much meaningless.
Yes, and this is sort of a model wanted by the OECD, saying that countries should sign those treaties, bilateral treaties, and it's the idea that you have access to information. It doesn't work well. It's not that efficient at all. But Canada signed those agreements and claimed to fight against secrecy. But the government changed the law so that when they sign such agreement, automatically a Canadian corporation may send in that jurisdiction, in a subsidiary that it would create there, assets and bring them back in Canada without paying tax. So they sign actually all these agreements to have access to information, but at the same time, they make sure that the information is useless for the tax agency because it's legal to send money there and bring it back to Canada because the law changed in Canada. So it's all ways that show that Canada is helping wealthy corporations to circumvent the tax system instead of enforcing it.
And it makes you wonder, what then do the words law and agreements and information sharing really mean? What do politicians really mean when they say they're going to tackle tax havens? I mean, the situation we have now is the supposedly non-tax haven nations sort of taking the clothes of the tax havens and wearing them. We've got a really accelerated race to the bottom between countries, between different locations on tax, on legislation. And going back to French President Sarkozy, he said, I don't want to make Monaco rich. I want the wealthy to come to France to spend their money. So I'm not going to be increasing taxes. And here we are now with this crazy race. There have been estimates recently from Eurodad that the average global corporate tax rate will be 0% by 2052. The Tax Justice Network actually thinks it'll be much sooner than that. We think that's quite optimistic. So I guess that brings me to ask you, how did we get into this situation? How did the incorporation of these kind of economic models into an onshore system from offshore become a kind of normalised fact of life that's barely questioned?
When I started to work on the topic in 1999, I was shocked by the importance of the matter. And I thought that stats, data weren't enough to talk about the issue, even though we needed them. But the whole political culture is changing because of that problem. And I think that the words we're using to describe our political world, the words such as border, law, crime, state, sovereignty, politics, economy, these words, the meaning of these words are changing because of the impact tax havens have on the geopolitic. And that's why I was interested in semantic. Words don't mean anything anymore if a trust may have, as a settler, a trustee, and a beneficiary, the same person. Investments have no meaning if they can be synonym to any transfer made throughout a computer from a jurisdiction to another, even though nothing is happening on the field. States have no meaning if Jersey is presented as the most important exporter of bananas in the world, or the British Virgin Islands as a major commercial partner of China. And it's not only about money laundering or tax avoidance. Of course, these problems are very important, but it's also about being able to talk about our world and be able to have the proper concepts and the proper notions to have an impact on it. Now we're sort of in a crazy fiction where you have all kind of data that don't cope with the reality.
Yeah, and even the use of the word laws has a very positive connotation. And even that means nothing, you're pointing out in your book, because, you know, you give the example of laws in Malta, for example, around shipping, laws in Hong Kong around trusts. And those are laws, but they're designed to stop other laws in other places. And it does all become a nonsense.
Yeah, absolutely. There are two ways to describe tax havens. They have a technical role and also a political role. Their technical role is quite known today, is that they allow phony transfer of assets so that these assets aren't taxed and aren't supervised by any serious jurisdiction. And on the other hand, they play a political role because they allow all kind of controversial activities to be described in the words, in the vocabulary of ordinary practices. So you have charitable foundations that do nothing related to charity. but they will remain charitable foundations. The rent to an airplane company like Air France planes, and they are called charitable foundations. You'll talk about investments that have nothing to do with economy. You'll have also states have such that aren't states because they don't rule on what is happening on their territory. They rule on what is happening everywhere in the world except in their own land. And why these states aren't state, why these structures aren't structures, why these laws aren't law, is that because they don't rule on life in society, they disrule on life in society. They all of a sudden allow things to happen that any law shouldn't tolerate. You have states that attract $21 trillion of dollars, at least, if we follow the analysis James Henry did for Tax Justice Network. They attract trillions and trillions of dollars in a sphere where no law applies under the law, where you have states that claim that there are no states anymore, or that state don't play any role anymore in anything, with silly laws and silly description of things. It's a dramatic situation.
Yes, and you make the point in your book, and I'm sure this is true for many other countries, that if Canada had never made any laws relating to Canadian companies in offshore jurisdictions in the past few decades, Canada would have been better off. You talk about laundering with language in your book, and so if we're unwittingly part of a laundering operation that you talk about with banking secrecy and semantic secrecy, how do we start to change our use of language to help us think and portray what's happening differently? I mean, how do we get out of it? It's like a trap.
I think that critical citizens, journalists, activists, anybody who believes in the importance of the meanings of the world should not use words that we usually have for economic activities when it's about tax havens. We shouldn't say that they are charitable foundations and tax havens. We shouldn't say that we find trust there. We shouldn't say that corporations in the Western countries invest in the Cayman Islands, in the Bahamas, in the Turk and Caicos Islands. We shouldn't say that they are states in the way because they are totally dominated by the financial sector. I mean, the financial sector, they manipulate them. And their laws are not law meant to govern their population. They are laws meant to allow big corporations and wealthy individuals to bypass their own legal system. So we should be able to find words to describe in a critical manner and just to name in a critical manner, descriptive manner, what these countries and these actors and these activities are, instead of laundering ourselves, these operations, while giving them names that aren't appropriate at all. I started my book saying that I'm in Canada, so each time someone waits for a bus 40 minutes at minus 15 or 20, it's because of tax havens. Every time someone waits for an important surgery for months from an hospital, it's because of tax havens. Every time there are a lack of nurses or professors in hospitals or in schools, it's because of tax havens. Because I wanted a relationship to be made between what's happening in our world and the offshore phenomenon. I believe in the relevancy of a dictionary to translate all these words in proper words, because we're full of euphemism. when we talk about tax havens. So a dictionary would be interesting.
Indeed it would. And in fact, you can watch this space because we hope to work with Alain Denault on a project like that with the working title of Rewording Offshore, where we'll call on poets, artists, campaigners, philosophers, journalists, citizens everywhere to see what we can come up with together, how we can redefine what's actually happening to our world. A new glossary of our words, not their words. Alain Denault's new book, Legalising Theft, A Short Guide to Tax Havens, is out in April 2018, published by Fernwood Publishing. It's a fascinating read. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.